But one of the reasons that Christianity should be able to think about uncertainty is that, you know, the starting point for Christianity is God and our understanding of God. And however much certain beliefs and doctrines are central and important, things that we care about as we speak about God, none of us fully know who God is. And that kind of fundamental fact that Christians begin with their understanding of God, who they know in part, but never completely, never fully, should shape everything.
I'm speaking today with my friend Mark Knight, who's professor in literature, religion, and Victorian studies at the University of Lancaster, and also general editor of the journal Literature and Theology. Mark's expertise includes 19th century fiction, theology, and post-secular criticism. We talk about his 2019 book, Good Words, Evangelicalism and the Victorian Novel, about the difference religion makes to how we understand the past, and about making a place for religion in the secular academy. I'm Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center. Mark Knight, my friend, it is so good to see you. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me today.
Cool. Thank you, Matt. It's very good to be here.
Coming from England. So it's morning time here, afternoon for you. So it's been a long day for you already. And it's about to get longer, Mark. No, hopefully not. Hopefully not. I often begin by asking our guests how they imagine faith in the context of their life and work. And in your case, I might get at that question by asking you about the conclusion to your 2019 book, Good Words. And I'm talking about a section of the book you label My Story. And I wonder if you could rehearse briefly the faith journey that you described there in that section of your book.
Yeah, absolutely. So I describe myself as an eclectic Protestant, if you like. So I was brought up in the Salvation Army, which is a curious kind of dissenting group with a strong emphasis on social justice. And then in my teens, I kind of went through something of the charismatic revival. So a particular kind of flavor of the Salvation Army there. And then, you know, for my late teens and into my 20s and 30s, I spent a lot of time with a group of people who were from the Salvation Army, but very much looking to kind of reimagine the church, reimagine what faith could look like in a different setting. So there were no uniforms or brass bands or some of those things, but a real desire to try and imagine how faith could look. Late 30s, I moved to Toronto and spent a few years there at an Anglo-Catholic church. And then when I moved back to the UK, I've ended up at an Anglican church here in Lancaster. So, you know, all very much within the Protestant tradition, but very different kind of experiences and denominations. So a widening out, I guess, of experience of what faith looks like and what it can mean and entail. And then along the way, I've been really fortunate to, you know, be able to read and engage with lots of kind of wonderful kind of theologians and Christian thinkers to help put some flesh on those bones.
That shows in your work, which is, I think, both informed by your own perspective, but also really enriched, I think, by your understanding of others' traditions and other theologies. I find that really wonderful about your work. I'm curious, I'll ask you a follow-up question to that. So I've been part of my own church, my own faith community, my entire life, though there are certainly chapters of my life that have been varied. I've felt different ways about it at different ages. I've been more or less committed to it. I've been happier or less happier. Have you had any experiences where you were outside of a church altogether, or have you been more or less a member of these faith communities all the way through, just different ones?
Yeah, so pretty much all the way through, a member of a faith community. I guess the weakest part of that has probably been since I've been back here in Lancaster. I mean, faith hasn't sort of diminished in any way, but the range of churches that are available in a fairly small town in the northwest of England is much less than I had when I was in London and Toronto. So finding a church that was a kind of a really good fit for me has just been a bit more difficult. And then, you know, obviously that's been exacerbated slightly during COVID, where getting out and meeting anyone has been a little bit harder. So it's definitely not outside a faith community, but perhaps more outside than other moments where that's just been a little bit easier in my life.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense. You know, it's one thing to identify as a person of faith and another to become a scholar of religion and literature like you are, and a very distinguished one. What led you down that particular path?
Well, it was an accident, really, or providential, so you can decide what you think about that. So during my undergraduate degree, I was trying to work out what I would do in the future, and decided that I enjoyed studying and I enjoyed the university and that I would like to do a PhD. I really was the most naive person going when it came to thinking about how that PhD would work. I applied to the English department at King's College London and ended up being accepted into the theology department because the most suitable supervisor was there. At that time, you know, I had some knowledge of theology and had been part of church for many years, but I'd never had any formal training in theology. And so it was a steep learning curve. You know, the number of embarrassing mistakes I made were too big to mention. And so I found myself, though really kind of by accident, sort of in a theology department, but very much thinking about literature. And my PhD was on the British writer G.K. Chesterton. So it was then that sort of, you know, between these two worlds, I had to try and make sense of them, find ways of putting them together. And really it will kind of develop from there.
Okay. I want to talk about this really terrific book you published back in 2019 titled Good Words. You describe it as an exploration of the relationship between evangelicalism and the Victorian novel. But it's also, you write, and this is quoting you, part of a larger and shared theoretical project about the place of religion in the modern world. Mm-hmm. It's that latter part I especially wanted to discuss with you, but I suppose I might begin the conversation by asking you whether you find 19th century fiction in particular to be fertile ground for thinking about religion in the modern world. If you do, why? What about the 19th century novel makes it such a rich, you know, sort of bed for considering these kinds of issues?
Yeah, I do find it a rich kind of area to think about these things. I guess in the 19th century, we've got so much change and transformation taking place, both within culture and society more generally, but certainly in the way that one thinks about faith. So the Christian faith both becomes more popular and then has a degree of decline in the 19th century. So there's these huge transformations in its popularity, but also the nature of what it means to have faith. So we get the fracturing of different denominations. We get the experience of different Christians of having to work out their understanding of faith in the world alongside others who don't think in the same way. And we just, as I said, we have this huge level of change and transformation. And then we also have many people who don't believe or are wondering what it means to believe. So it's that level of transformation. It's that level of change, that need for faith to adapt, to reimagine, to rethink itself, that I find so exciting and so complex, because it's, you know, it's never straightforward and there's always very, very different ways in which one might think about it.
Yeah, and that act of imagination, I mean, you really bring that out in these chapters, and also the stakes of what really is in play here. You know, there's a very influential tradition in literary scholarship, as you know, which views the novel as an inherently secular art form, right? It's a reflection of human life in an era defined by secular forces like science and industrialization and eventually technology and so on. But you argue that really we don't need to see the novel as a secular art form, and your book's five chapters present different ways that religion informs the imaginations of 19th century novelists and characters and plot lines. So I'm just looking over these chapters. I mean, you know, chapter one is about Thackeray and how they read in relation to the classic book, Pilgrim's Progress. The chapter on Dickens and conversion, a chapter on Wilkie Collins's detective novel, The Moonstone, and how we interpret. Maybe we should begin, this is the next question that follows, defining what you mean and don't mean by evangelicalism. All right, so what is that in 19th century context?
Yeah, the most famous scholar on evangelicalism is a guy called David Bevington, so a historian of religion. And he says, when we're talking about evangelicalism, it's a movement, so it's not a singular denomination. It's present in the Church of England and outside of it. And he says it's characterized by four traits. So biblicism, looking to the Bible as an authority, is central. Crucicentrism, so this focus on the cross as the key area of theology. Conversionism, so a belief that conversion is important and a desire to convert others. And fourthly, activism, a desire to be involved, to transform, to try and change the world in some way. Now, all of these traits are present in other Christian denominations, but the way in which they come together and are accentuated within the evangelical movement, Beberton says that's, you know, that's a good description of it. And it's not a perfect description. And plenty of other scholars of evangelicalism have wondered whether we might add one or two bits to it. But I think it's a really good starting point. I think the other thing to say about evangelicalism, what we mean by it and what we don't, is, of course, in our own time, it's really associated very strongly with the religious right in the United States. And, you know, in some ways, I can understand why. There's certain beliefs or traits or commitments for evangelicals that would be compatible with certain versions of republicanism, so one can see that. But the key thing to remember is that evangelicalism is not inevitably associated with the right. So there are plenty of parts of the evangelical tradition where we might think about evangelicals as being on the left, as being on reformers, as being believers in a state that might intervene, transform and change things. And that mix is really important to recover, right? Which is not to say that, you know, Republicans can't, or evangelicals can't be Republicans, but the point is that they don't have to be. And in the 19th century, we really do see that mix of evangelicals that are more conservative and those that are more liberal, and a whole range of positions in between.
Yeah, it's a really important nuance that you explain in the book, and did really, really well to explain right here, Mark. Thank you very much. So you discuss in that chapter on Thackeray, you discuss the anxiety that many evangelicals felt about the content of novels and the effect of novels on young readers. I mean, you know, it's just an age-old concern. It was there. I was trained as an 18th centuryist, and it's certainly there in the 18th century. It's there in more contemporary periods too. And scholars sometimes smile a little condescendingly at these concerns, like, you know, that you would have, felt you had to protect your kids from Charles Dickens or something like this. But you point out, I think this is a very good observation of yours, that modern readers, especially in universities, tend not to acknowledge often enough the effects that our reading of literature has on us. Mm-hmm. Can you comment? I mean, I thought that was a really great observation.
Yeah, I mean, Matt, like you, I was brought up reading and having highlighted to me many of these accounts where the silly evangelicals were just very nervous about fiction. And of course, we know better. And in a sense, one can see that there's no straightforward relation between reading fiction and morality. Clearly, reading a good book doesn't necessarily make you a person, and reading about something bad doesn't make you a bad person. And the question, the ethics that are at stake when we read are complex and difficult and need to be thought about in all sorts of ways. So, of course, I do understand that reaction against some of those more extreme evangelical concerns about the moral effect of reading. But I do think that they're getting at something that is important and is worth thinking about, that presumably all of us who read believe that in some sense there's some meaning to our reading. We believe and we know and we experience that texts have an effect on us. They can elicit joy, they can elicit sadness, they can connect with different experiences, they can prompt us to act in certain ways, they can discourage us from doing other things, they offer opportunities for reflection. They work in all sorts of different ways. And what I'm trying to get at in that chapter and starting to think through, and I certainly don't have great answers for this, but I'm trying to think through how does fiction affect us? It must affect us in some ways. And sure, that's not in a very straightforward, one-dimensional manner. Just because it's not as simple as some of those evangelicals earlier in the 19th century said, that doesn't mean that we should discount what they're saying altogether. We just need, you know, more complex ways of trying to think about the ethics of reading and the effect that reading has on us.
Why do you think we're so squeamish, we moderns, you know, about owning our investments in fiction or in claiming, for example, the moral good of literature. I mean, you point out very well, these things are complicated. They're complex. And we need to sort of be really careful in how we configure responses to these kinds of questions. But we seem so very unsettled, uncertain about even venturing these kinds of claims. Why is that? Why are we so nervous?
That's a really good question. And I think there's several answers to it. So I certainly don't think there's one. One aspect is a reaction. So much thought works in these ways. We hear an idea, we think it's wrong, and we just, you know, go in the opposite direction. And some of the early accounts of literature, why one should study literature and what the purpose of literature was, and we might think back to a figure like Matthew Arnold here, so much of modern thought is a reaction against that. So that's one aspect. But I think another aspect is just this difficulty that so many scholars in the humanities have of thinking about their own relation to the ideas that they describe. It's uncomfortable. It's safer and easier to rely on more detached forms of reading and commentary, where we pretend that we're apart from the things that have been described. And perhaps that feeling of being detached and apart and provides a justification for us to think that we know exactly what's going on and we can comment in a neutral and unbiased manner. There may be an aspect of trying to kind of copy or emulate the sciences there, to be that detached observer that doesn't get too emotionally invested and involved. But actually in practice, all of us are very much involved with these stories that we read. These things have an effect on us. We care about them. And I think there is this need for all of us to find ways of owning and understanding and reflecting on our own very personal and emotional investments in the stories that we read and the conversations that we have.
That's well said. You know, I think back to a story when I was just a very, very young scholar in my job here at BYU. And when I was writing a book, I was revising my dissertation, or what in England, the thesis, right? And I was trying to ask some hard, like, what's this really saying? What's this doing? You know, and I went to a senior colleague and I was trying to talk it through with him. And I said, I think I'm trying to talk about like the emergence of critical thinking. And his point, he said to me, yeah, every book's about that. He wasn't being congratulatory. He was being a little bit dismissive. He was saying, look, you need to think more carefully about what you're really trying to say. Is that really all you have to say, is that this thing you're writing about is about critique? Not that that's wrong or bad. It's not. It's important. But but is that really all that's at stake here? Is that, and there is a kind of a tendency toward, we're comfortable talking about detachment and being detached in doing it. And as you point out, that's not necessarily a part of the long history of reading, or the richest history of reading.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's quite striking for me is I think there's a difference between the way scholars write for academic journals or presses and the way that they teach. Now, the way people teach is, of course, you know, varies in all sorts of ways. But I think that for many scholars, their experience in the classroom is a place where they're much more likely to find space for reflecting on experience, emotion, acknowledging that a book's affected them, inviting students to reflect on the way that a book has moved them or provoked them to think about something. Whereas often when we actually come to scholarship, we resort to a more limited mode of inquiry, much more detached, much more historical, much more evidentiary. And again, those things aren't wrong, but it surely can't be all that's going on. And you know, my sense is that for most scholars, their experience in the classroom tends to be sort of epistemologically richer than the kind of work that we end up writing.
I think that's right. Yeah, absolutely. Let me ask you a different, let me pivot a bit to a different topic. So many people, but in some ways it's a similar topic. So many people associate religion with strong convictions, right? Sometimes with a kind of a delusional certainty, right? That you believe in God, therefore you have some sense that you know how the world's going to end and when or something. But in so much of your work, you describe something very different, right? Which is the resource that religion and theology present for negotiating uncertainty. So I guess I've got a couple questions. I'll ask you this one first. First, how is it so that religion and theology prepare us to be able to negotiate uncertainty?
I mean, you know, first up, I want to acknowledge that for the history of the church, you know, we've often got it wrong, and that there are, you know, plenty of examples, however much there shouldn't be in what I'm about to say, but there's plenty of examples of Christians who have just, you know, asserted very dogmatically their faith, not listened to others, and being unfortunately arrogant as they do so. So it's a mistake that, you know, is still with us. But one of the reasons that Christianity should be able to think about uncertainty is that, you know, the starting point for Christianity is God and our understanding of God. And however much certain beliefs and doctrines are central and important, and things that we care about as we speak about God, none of us fully know who God is. We couldn't possibly. So, you know, even in the scriptures, we get something of that because we get these multiple books all giving us these sort of fragmentary accounts of people's experience in God and understanding of what he's like. And that kind of fundamental fact that Christians begin with their understanding of God, who they know in part, but never completely, never fully, should shape everything. And so, it should be, sometimes isn't, but it should be easy for Christians to embrace uncertainty, because it's fundamental to our claim about who God is. It's not that we don't know him at all, but we know in part, only ever in part, and that should dictate everything else for us.
That really rings true for me. I mean, it's the difference between having a conviction that God is versus feeling that one understands who God is, and that is in, even for the most earnest pilgrim, that is always in process of revision, always, always, mm-hmm. always. Let me ask you this then. I'm curious, this might be an impossible question. If it is, just say, Matt, this is impossible and we'll move on. All right. Do you see this capacity to negotiate complexity reflected at all in the work of scholars who take up religion and literature? I mean, do they seem to be able to be good at acknowledging the provisionality of their conclusions? Or is there a kind of a reflexive self-defensiveness about even writing about religion, for example, in an academic climate that can be quite secular, that makes them want to profess more certainty, et cetera? I guess I'm asking you whether scholarly work in religion and literature has, as you've noticed it, any discernible effect on the character of the critic writing it.
Yeah, it's a really good and difficult question. I mean, I think it does, but not in the perfect way that we might like. I mean, the analogy one might use is to look at a church. So, to look at the people in a church, should being a Christian have an effect on you? Yes. Does it? Yes. Can we find examples of, you know, wonderful Christians who have, you know, helped transform the world, transform the lives of others, who demonstrate, you know, qualities of generosity and kindness and faithfulness, etc.? Yes, absolutely. But is that all we find in church? No. And we find examples of kind of, you know, failure and arrogance and, you know, abuse and so forth. Yes, unfortunately, yes. And this is the challenge. And I think it's very much the same thing when it comes to thinking about scholars and religion and literature. So I can think of lots of wonderful scholars of religion and literature who don't just have something intelligent to say, but model the way of saying it that I would look to and see as distinctively Christian. I can think of lots of those examples. And you know, I, Matt, like you, are privileged to know many of those people and to benefit from the time that I spend with them. But I can also, you know, I can think of plenty of examples that aren't that. And I'm sure it's probably the same when I look at my own life as well. You know, I can see moments when I think, oh, maybe I started to get that right, and plenty of moments when I was just as guilty of the flaws that I'm seeing others myself.
You know, I do feel fortunate to, I love what you say there, Mark. I do feel fortunate to know lots of people who really model the kinds of difficult but moral and inspiring Christian positions that they write about. I see you as one of those people, and certainly my interactions with you, I see you as a very generous critic toward those who see the world differently from you, for example. And in fact, your attitude and a lot of your work seems to be less polemical, less argumentative than it is suggestive, right? It returns to the idea that religion presents us with alternative ways to read texts and different ways to understand our lives. And I'll just ask you this, maybe this is obvious, but maybe it's not. Why opt for this approach, right? Why not make a stronger and more argumentative case for the validity of religious readings? Why take the approach of the one who presents an alternative?
Yeah, there's lots of reasons for this. I mean, one is I don't fully know God. I don't fully know the word. I don't have all of the answers. And that's, you know, that's a fundamental reason that I'm uncomfortable with a very dogmatic approach to just, you know, proudly, loudly declaring ideas and presuming that I've got them right, because I just know that I haven't. And you know, that journey, that process of continuing to understand and reflect and see the places where I've got things wrong is ongoing. So that's, you know, that's a fundamental reason. I guess there's also the issue that practically, those Christians, whether they're in universities or outside, who very aggressively declare their faith and presume that they've got it right, they just don't convince anyone. They're not attractive. So I kind of remember this growing up and starting to, you know, read the work of different apologists, some of whom, you know, were terrific, but lots of whom, you know, just were not attractive people. I mean, who's interested in someone who tells them that they've got everything wrong? So there's a pragmatism to this as well. You know, I just don't think that loudly declaring and presuming that we've got everything right and we have all the answers, I don't think it has a positive effect on anybody. But also, as I said, it's a false position, because none of us have fully understood anything, and there's always new things to learn. There's always different ways of viewing the world, different ways of understanding God, things that we can learn from other people. So, yeah, I hope that goes kind of some way to answering your question.
It does. Yeah, very well said. And I really appreciate the way you model that in your own work. Do you find the generosity you try to extend to other critics, especially secular critics, accorded to you in turn by them?
Sometimes, not always. And that's probably how we would expect things to be. So yeah, sometimes. So I can think of plenty of critics who hold no religious belief at all, but are wonderful people, generous people, willing to kind of think and listen, even where we disagree on a particular point. And, you know, and I've been privileged enough to meet lots and work with lots of those people over time. And I'm, you know, always very grateful for that. So yeah, sometimes, but not always. I think those of us who express faith, particularly in literary studies, we do have to kind of overcome a certain suspicion and perhaps some latent hostility to what's being said. And there's often good reasons why that's so. There's a long history why that's so. Sometimes we find that the critics who are most hostile to faith have just had a bad experience of faith or a person of faith at some point in their life. So I've met some, you know, very generous critics who are not believers and others who are not. But I guess even when I'm thinking about those who are not, although always, of course, the temptation is to, you know, feel that we're victimized and to look to point out the flaws in others. You know, there's always plenty of flaws in our own life, plenty of moments where we're equally guilty of the same hostility and the same refusal to listen. And I think on the whole, our attention is better spent trying to work out the things that we've got wrong rather than just trying to point them out in other people.
Yeah, that's great. You know, cast the mote out of your own eye, right? Yeah, and then you'll see better how to cast it out of the exactly right. Cast the beam, I guess, out of your own eye. I want to talk about a couple of essays that you've written recently that I have had a chance to see, which are just terrific essays. One more question about Good Words. It's this, again, subtitled Evangelicalism and the Victorian Novel. It's such a great book, and it's got some really rich readings of various pieces of 19th century literature. Was there a part of the book that was the most difficult to write or the most pleasurable to write? I mean, was there part of this with which you spent more time or thought more about since it was published?
I mean, the book was written, you know, lots of different moments. There's, that's why you just see slightly different things going on in different chapters. And the same chapter was actually the most difficult to write and the most pleasurable to write. And that was the final chapter, which is a chapter on The Way of All Flesh by Samuel Butler. Yeah. And I, you know, I'd read The Way of All Flesh and I started to see kind of connections between the narrator of The Way of All Flesh, who wants to sort of look at evangelicalism at a distance, and some of the debates that were and have been taking place around post-critique and the work of people like Rita Felsky, and a desire to think about whether we all always stand back from the position that we're thinking about or whether there are alternatives. So that's how that chapter started out. And it began okay. And then about two thirds of the way through, I just got stuck. And I just didn't know how to resolve it. And I spent ages, I was trying to read about maybe the answer is going to be in some sort of personal type of criticism and thought. And I read various philosophers on there and, you know, they were interesting, but they weren't really doing what I wanted to do in the chapter. And then, you know, quite late on, I think I realized that actually this maybe the best way of thinking about this would be to take a more sort of self-reflexive turn. And that's really where the end of that chapter goes, as I start to kind of reflect on, you know, my own position. And, you know, in hindsight, I guess that seems pretty obvious, but it took me a long while to work out that was the best way to go. So it was the most difficult chapter, but also the most rewarding. I think once I worked out that that was the way to finish that chapter off, it was quite quick to write, very enjoyable to write. And for me, who knows for readers, but certainly for me, it helped make sense of some of the discussions that was happening in that chapter.
I would have guessed that you would pick that chapter. Yeah, it's a wonderful chapter of the book. And we began our discussion by me asking you about the end of that chapter, that section called My Story. I don't think that was an obvious way to end at all. I thought it was actually quite ingenious but perfect. It's a perfect way, I think, to conclude the chapter and book. The way you do. So I thought it was an inspired ending. Well done. Bravo you. let me ask you about one of your forthcoming essays. Or actually, it's not forthcoming. It's a recent essay here. This is the one where you talk about semi-detached reading. It's an essay just published in Renaissance, right? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Just this year. Titled Wells, Chesterton, and a Theology of Semi-Detached Reading. And you describe semi-detached reading as a way of explaining how we as readers can become absorbed in imaginative scenarios without losing our footing in the everyday worlds that we inhabit. So we can be fully in a novel, but still recognize that the novel is not the world that we are living in otherwise outside of the pages. And you think about that model of semi-detachment by way of theology and suggesting that theology takes the idea of semi-detachment even further, right? Can you explain how that is?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the starting point for that essay was I was reading the work of John Plotz, a critic of Victorian literature, who's got a book on semi-detachment. And it's, you know, he's brilliant. He's read so much and he's such a smart guy. And, you know, it's a wonderful book. And I was reading him with Wells and I was teaching some Wells. And what struck me was that although, you know, John's range of reading is incredible, but he just doesn't talk about theology at all. And he doesn't talk about religious experience at all. And of course, you know, none of us talk about everything, but it was so striking given the range of reference in his book. So I got to trying to think about, well, maybe we should think about this, but if I'm going to make that claim that there is a value to thinking about theology, you know, semi-detachment, then the onus is on me to make a claim about why it might be important to do so. And that's, I guess, the kind of the question you're answering. So I could see lots of sort of structural links between that ability to read, to be sort of in the fictional world and out of it, and the experience that Christians have, the sense of being in this world and out of it simultaneously. And it struck me that there were, I mean, many things, but kind of three things that I wanted to highlight for what theology might bring. So firstly, that theology has this kind of long history of narrating our experience of being semi-detached, of both being in and absorbed by, but also outside of the world simultaneously. But secondly, that theologians have ways of trying to configure that relationship So, you know, most famously, when Christians think about the kingdom, we think about a kingdom that is now and not yet, a kingdom that Christ inaugurates that is present, but of course not fully realized. So this is a way of trying to configure the relationship between two different worlds. And that thirdly, you know, Christians, both theologians and, you know, lay people have all sorts of experience of trying to negotiate the conflict between being different worlds. That sense of thinking that we ought to do one thing and yet also ought to do something very different. And again, it's certainly not that, you know, theology has all of the answers to this, but it has a long history of trying to think about it. And it seems to me that any tradition, religious or otherwise, that has a long history of thinking through a problem is worth listening to, because if they've thought it through enough, they've probably got some ideas and thoughts about how one might move forward.
Yeah, it's a great piece. And I think it's very persuasive what you say. And I think it builds in very helpful ways on Plotz's book. So, you know, well done. You know, a couple of years ago, back in the summer of 2019, when no one ever heard of COVID, I was privileged to participate in a workshop sponsored by the National Endowment of the Humanities on the subject of religion, secularism, and the novel. And you led this workshop with Lori Branch. It was terrific. I loved it. And the workshop really ended up being a lot about the subject of the post-secular, right? Sometimes also referred to as the heightened interest in religion and scholarly work. Are you happy with the state of post-secularity in literary studies? Is the field yielding what you thought or maybe hoped it would yield, say, 10 years ago when you looked forward?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I'm happy in that I can see lots of wonderful things taking place. So, you know, I didn't start out thinking of myself as someone who worked on the post-secular. Started out thinking of myself as someone who was interested in the relationship between literature and religion. And the post-secular is one expression of that. It's not the only way of configuring that relationship, but it's certainly one, and one that I'm happy to think about and own, because the post-secular is really an attempt to try and think through the relationship between the relation and the secular and better understand it. And that's, you know, that's an ongoing, slow and long journey. So, you know, the post-secular and religion literature are perhaps not quite the same thing, but lots of overlap, and I'm certainly very invested in both. So yes, I'm satisfied in that. I can think, again, of lots of people doing some brilliant work, really smart work, and the conversation feels lively and it feels vibrant and there feels very different voices. And it's not just one thing. And I think this is all absolutely terrific. So kind of happy and satisfied, yes, but I certainly don't think that we've cracked it. So there's still so much to kind of work through. And just on a practical note, for me, I continue to read different contributors to that discussion and have my thinking changed as I read them. And that seems to me a good thing, but also a clear reminder that this is not an exhaustive discussion. There's lots to be done, lots more to be thought about, lots of other ways of trying to configure these relations and how we think about them.
Do you have any sense for where you think the field is going, or any hope for where you'd like it to go over the, say, the next 10 years?
Yeah. Where do I hope it will go? Well, I hope it will continue. I hope that this will remain on people's agenda as something that is important and worth talking about. I hope that we will continue to see a bunch of new scholars coming through who are interested in thinking these issues through. I see that at the moment, and I certainly hope that continues at all levels, from the, you know, the Arlwine institutions to community colleges, in, you know, in all sorts of different expressions. These seem to be important debates. They look a bit different in different settings, but they're all important, and the contributors to them are very important in all of those places. They all have something to bring. So that's what I see going on, and I hope that continues. I suspect our vocabulary will change. I'm sure that term post-secular will have a certain shelf life to it. That's normal and right, actually. All words continue to change, and this is just a part of that. So, I guess in 20 years, we won't be thinking about the post-secular. We'll be thinking about it in a different way. But as long as the sort of debates that are being picked up are still being thought about, that strikes me as fine. I think in terms of what am I concerned about with it. I wouldn't want our understanding of the post-secular to ever ossify. So in the same way, they wouldn't want our understanding of theology in any way to ever ossify. So that's a perpetual concern. It's not that I think it's about to, but it's always a risk. I think there is probably a risk that sometimes the post-secular just becomes, this kind of nice sort of middle ground. And in doing that, it can sometimes lose a certain sort of theological specificity, whether that's being fed by the Christian faith or indeed any other faith. And that's to be avoided, because the best discussions come when people have very distinctive positions from different faith perspectives and no faith perspective, and bring those points of view into dialogue with each other. So I guess, that's a concern, perhaps, that the post-secular doesn't just become this general nice middle ground, but remains distinctive in different ways. It continues to develop. But I think it's an exciting field, and I keep seeing lots of great new scholars coming through who are making important contributions to this and thinking about it in ways that I haven't. So it feels lively to me, and I hope that continues.
That's great. On the subject, I guess, of the specificity of positions that leads to the richest arguments, and you are the general editor of the journal Literature and Theology, which is a fantastic journal. You do a great job there, Mark. I've had the good fortune to talk with Ramana Huck and Mark Eaton, who also edit journals in this field. Ramana is the editor of Religion and Literature, and Mark of Christianity and Literature. And I put this question to them. I'll ask it of you also. Is the best work that you see in the field, or that's submitted to your journal, Literature and Theology, like the best work you see submitted to non-religious journals in the field? That is, is it an intelligent, incisive, kind of cutting edge in lots of ways? Or is the work that you see for you qualitatively different somehow, or should it be different as a function of its theological subject matter?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I want to have it both ways on this, so I
You
hope that's
may,
not
yeah.
cheating. I mean, the way I guess I would think about this would be some sort of Venn diagram with lots of overlapping circles. I mean, work that's published in Literature and Theology, or work that's published in Victorian studies, to take another example, these shouldn't be radically different. I mean, these are scholars in both, who are, often reading similar material, and we're often looking for similar sorts of things. So the kind of work that goes in literature and theology shouldn't be completely radically different, but it's not going to be the same. And one of the reasons it's not going to be the same is that for literature and theology, the interdisciplinary nature of thinking about literature and theology and the theoretical ramifications of that are going to be more prominent. So it's possible that someone might submit a piece to Victorian studies that was, very theological. And indeed, that should be the case. Victorian studies is meant to be a very interdisciplinary journal, but inevitably, there's probably a little bit less space for that kind of long history of theology in that journal than there would be in ours. And that's as it should be. I mean, that's why we have lots of different journals. So I do think that when we put those disciplines, literature and theology, together, we end up with something that's distinctive and not quite the same as anything else. But I also think there's quite a bit of overlap. And I think we might think about that as well when we're even thinking about those three journals, together, Christianity and Literature, Religion and Literature, and Literature and Theology. They're not quite the same. There's lots of essays that could appear in any of them. So there's lots of overlap between them. And actually, that overlap is quite good sometimes, because it's good for people to have more than one option for where they can publish. But that our work is all slightly different as well. Christianity and literature obviously is going to foreground Christianity more. Religion and literature has really done a terrific job in the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years or so of widening its scope and bringing different religious traditions outside of Christianity into the mix, and that's been really important. And literature and theology, both thinking about theology and religious studies and their theoretical reflections on those, that's probably a bit more distinctive in a journal. So again, there's lots of overlap, but they're slightly different. And that's how I would think about them. And I also think about that overlap has been a healthy thing.
Mark, it's been such a pleasure talking with you. I'm grateful for your friendship and for your excellent work in the field. Again, you do a lot through what you write, and you do a lot also through how you teach and how you engage other scholars in the field. So thank you for what you do, and best of luck to you.
Great. Thank you very much, Matt. It's been a real privilege to be here.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Brooke Brown and Abby Thatcher. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.